Today's show is sponsored by Ting. Go to dancarlin.ting.com and save $25 off your first device when you sign up.
There's a reason it doesn't sound like the old media. That's because it's the new media. He's Dan Carlin, and this is Common Sense.
For months now, ever since we did the show we called Poking the Bear, which is about five and a half months ago, people have been asking me via Twitter or other outlets, and by the way, you can follow us if you want to at DC Common Sense, whether or not we were seeing the beginnings of a stumbling towards the Third World War. You know, because we've been talking about the First World War so often in the history show, people are seeing similarities as to how dominoes can fall in unexpected ways and wondering if that's what we're seeing with the expanding amount of tension, which has gotten much worse in the past couple of weeks, over Ukraine. Now, I don't know when you're going to get this, so a quick recap, but basically, the former territory of the Soviet Union and the Russian Empire before that, which broke away like many other holdings when the Soviet Union fell, has been sort of involved in an ebb and flow, a tug, mainly geographical, people will say, between the eastern part of the country, which sort of leans one way broadly, more towards ties with Russia, and the western part of the country, which leans broadly, more towards a Western orientation. And there's been kind of a great game. Do you know what a great game refers to? The great game is a famous competition in the 1800s between the Russian Empire and the British Empire in Central Asia, mostly. But it basically talks about positioning between major powers, something below the threshold of war, but always seeking to gain advantage and sort of doing warfare without war, I guess you could say, something more than just peaceful competition, something less than war. And there are great games going all throughout history everywhere. I mean, that's standard operating procedure underneath the radar. And that's what's been going on in Ukraine, and that's why there have been orange revolutions and changes in governments, and when one government comes in, it'll lean more toward the east, and another government will come in, lean more toward the west. It's a destabilized area, and I think that it's normal that when you've had such a geopolitical upheaval as the fall of the Soviet Union, that you're going to have a sort of destabilized period afterwards, as countries sort of find their new level. And people have been saying to me, Dan, is this face-off that we're seeing in the latest situation between Russia and the West? And I say the West for lack of a better word. That to me is a Cold War term. It seems as outdated as saying conservatives and liberals and Democrats and Republicans and all the – just another one of those phrases that's outlived its usefulness, but we haven't really invented anything to take its place yet. So call it America and friends, the EU, the United States, NATO, whatever. But people have been saying, you know, are we seeing something that could lead through miscalculations to a terrible Holocaust? And I keep saying, no, don't worry, that's not what you're seeing. I'm starting to think that I'm a lot less sure, maybe that's a good way to put it, than I was when I was making these assurances to those of you who asked me that question. And the reason, if true, is because I once again, as we all do, right, miscalculated the intelligence and the wisdom of the political leadership. Which reminds me, and I've quoted this many times, I should actually go find, you know, put a little time into finding the actual quote so I don't mangle it or put words into the late Christopher Hitchens mouth. But there was, I've never forgotten it because it was one of those things that when you read it as a former journalist, am I a journalist anymore, Ben? What would you call me? I don't know what to call me. People say, can you give me a two-line bio, Dan? And I never know what to put. But Christopher Hitchens talks about this famous moment he says every journalist has when they actually get to sit down and have dinner with someone in the power structure, only to find out during the course of the dinner that they're nowhere near as intelligent as you thought they were. And then, somewhere before the dessert comes, you realize that they're not as smart as you are. And then somewhere before the bill arrives and the check and you check out of the restaurant, you realize, well, wait a minute, if this guy's not as smart as I am, maybe his contemporaries aren't as smart as I am, which means the entire world is being run by people not as smart as I am. And then you begin to panic a little, right? Because one of the things that allows us to sleep well at night is this idea that smarter people than us are running the show. I have to say that I think the way this Ukraine crisis is being handled is direct evidence that we may be wrong about that. And that, once again, I too, you know, I'm a pretty savvy guy, right? I've lived 50 years almost. I'm into diplomatic history. I love international relations. I pay attention to this stuff, and it fooled me. I fell into the trap, maybe, because the way we are handling the entire situation over Ukraine is pathetic and stupid. And you know, I have a friend, and we'll talk about this stuff sometimes, and I will bring up the stupid angle, and he will say, it's not as stupid as you think, because there's stuff going on behind the scenes that explains why things are going the way they are. It looks stupid, but if you really understood what was happening, you would understand the rationales. And what he means by that is that in places like Ukraine, there's a great game happening, just like we talked about with Russia, the Russian Empire, and the British. And the great game refers to all the money that's being made, you know, by pulling Ukraine out of the Russian orbit, right? I mean, there's gas deals to be had. There's resource extraction to be had. Joseph Biden's son sits on a board. Does he still sit on the board, Ben, of the Ukrainian gas company? I mean, this is all part of the spoils. What's at stake? The United States doesn't really care, sorry, Ukrainians, about whether you're free or not. They care about whether or not your area is open up to the capitalistic West for investment and exploitation, and are you a market we can exploit? I mean, things like that. That's what we care about all over the world, right? An open free market system where, you know, direct competition can we and the Russians can compete for Ukrainian, what's the monetary denomination in Ukraine, right? But I mean, essentially, the United States and Britain and places like that, we're trying to create a nice free market playing field for everyone. But the reason that we're being stupid about this is we are directly and consciously ignoring anything the Russians think about this. And you know, I think that the last show we did is a wonderful example of this. And let me tell you what happened after we did Poking the Bear 5 or 5.5 months ago, when, by the way, the situation was at a much less tense level than it is now. And we'll get to where it is now in a second, but it's a little bit shocking how far it's, and how quickly it's come. You begin to see how people in earlier eras might have viewed the onrushing tide of events once they start to ramp up. Nonetheless, we did a show 5.5 months ago where we were talking about being careful. Don't poke the bear was basically the theme of the show. But what we were saying is, listen, Russia has interests too, and it would be smart not to antagonize them. And one of the things we quoted in the show was this I don't even know what the proper word is. We said that Russia had guarantees from NATO and the West when they pulled their forces out of East Germany and allowed the Cold War to essentially end, that NATO, the anti-Russian alliance, right, would not move directly next to Russia's borders. I was one of many people saying that. After we did that show, there was an almost international debate over whether or not such guarantees were made. German news magazines focused on it. Newspapers here in the West focused on it. Reporters and journalists went to people who were there, whether they're U.S. Negotiators or Russians who were there, and asked, you know, was this guarantee ever made? People were tweeting me links to news articles and saying things like, it's a myth, Dan. Nobody ever made, you know, this promise to the Russians that NATO wouldn't expand toward their borders. And, you know, I find something indicative of this entire situation in that question, because it's a little like saying, hey, you didn't have it in writing. It ignored, you know, it's funny because it's almost exactly what you hear the U.S. and the Western NATO side say in this whole thing, right? We never promised that NATO wouldn't expand toward their borders, as though that's supposed to make the Russians feel better, right? As though if you said to them, hey, you should have gotten it in writing, and they should go home going, darn, should have had a lawyer. That's not what great powers do. This isn't a negotiation between two companies, and one company goes to the arbitrator and says, we had a deal, and the other company says, show me the contract. And the arbitrator says, well, didn't have a contract, sorry. That's not how it functions, folks. The Russians aren't going to feel any better because there wasn't something in writing. I can say right now, maybe I was wrong suggesting that there was some official deal. It doesn't matter. All that matters is the Russians feel threatened by it. And I love this point. I love that we say that they have nothing to be afraid of. NATO is no threat to you. Without acknowledging how we would feel if the shoe were on the other foot. And it's fascinating how many people will accuse me of a lack of patriotism for simply trying to view things from the other guy's position. You know, where I come from, that's just a natural way to get a three-dimensional view of the problem. To some people, it's an unpatriotic thing to see things from any viewpoint other than our own. And it's interesting because I'll hear from Ukrainians and people, for example, in the Baltic states, Finland sometimes, who are absolutely petrified about what the Russians might do. And I might even suggest traumatized by their history. And if you look at their history, who can blame them, right? And I'll hear from them. There's two refrains I often hear. Sometimes I hear both in the same sentence. Refrain number one is that Putin is a Hitlerian figure, right? That he is like Hitler. His goals are similar to Hitler, and the lessons that we supposedly learned about Hitler, which are not true. But these ideas that, for example, you cannot appease dictators. This is 1938. This is Munich all over again. And Putin is Hitler. I'll hear that. And by the way, if you believe that, that really constrains your choices, right? You can't just use statecraft 101 if we're dealing with Hitler. The other thing you'll hear from people is that Russia is almost, you know, if countries had DNA and countries had genes, Russia is almost genetically predisposed to expansion and imperialism. That unless it encounters some sort of counterforce, Russia will expand as far as it can, like the blob. Once again, if you really believe that to be true, why negotiate at all? It constrains your range of choices far more than if you say, well, this is, you know, international relations 101. This is standard power politics. Let's deal with it the way you would deal with standard power politics. You can't. It's Hitler. You can't. This is Nazi Germany. I mean, that sort of hyperbole may make sense if you've lived under the Russian boot, as many of these people have, for so long. At the same time, it's manifestly untrue. And the way you know it's manifestly untrue is if you were to take the situation that the Russians find themselves in with NATO expansion and instead put the United States in that situation, I would put it to you, we would react exactly the same way. Exactly. And if that's the case, how can Putin be Hitler if a U.S. president, whether a Democratic or Republican one, would do the same thing? How can Russia be, you know, almost genetically predisposed to expansion if the U.S. would do the same thing were the Warsaw Pact expanding to our borders? And before you argue that point, understand that we've already lived that history. Let me name a few countries to you just off the top of my head. Guatemala, Honduras, Panama, the Dominican Republic, Grenada, Haiti, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Chile, Mexico. Should I go on? These are all nations where the U.S. invoked something called the Monroe Doctrine. You know what that is, right? Goes back to the 1820s. There have been corollaries and expansions of the idea ever since. John Kerry said in 2013 it's dead. But of course, let's see it tested again. And basically what the Monroe Doctrine did all the way back to the 1820s is establish the United States' sphere of influence. And it was breathtaking. The U.S. wasn't saying that the United States was our sphere of influence. They weren't even saying North America is our sphere of influence. The United States was saying that our sphere of influence is this hemisphere, which, by the way, we've extended all the way to the entire globe now. Something that happens in Central Africa can be an imposition on our sphere of influence. If you go back and you read a speech by Ronald Reagan, for example, in 1986, where he's talking about asking Congress for funding, billions of dollars, to support a 20 to 30,000 man guerrilla army to overthrow the government of Nicaragua because he feels like it's creating a Soviet base. As he said, a mere 2 hours flight time from the United States, you begin to see that that's exactly what the story here is for the Russians. They don't want, you know, an enemy military base anywhere near them. And Ukraine is a lot closer to Moscow than Nicaragua was to Washington or even to the U.S. border. There was a conference, was it back in January, Ben? I don't remember, where perhaps the most elder statesman we have who pushes the idea of realpolitik, the politics of realism, right, as opposed to idealism. One of these guys that, you know, goes back to ancient Greece, basically, for his ideas about power politics, Henry Kissinger. And Kissinger was asked about the situation in Ukraine, and he said a couple of things. One thing he said is that this is not Hitler and Czechoslovakia, even though there are people, especially Ukrainians, who are panicking about this, and understandably so, who are trying to make that case, right? This is not Hitler and Czechoslovakia. The other thing that Kissinger said, and I'm paraphrasing here because I don't remember exactly what he said, but I remember it's all he had to say. He threw his hands up, and all he said to the panelist was, it's 300 miles from Moscow. The inference there is, would the U.S. put up with, you know, enemy bases 300 miles from Washington, D.C.? Look at how freaked out we've been for 50 years over Cuba. 2 days ago, presidential hopeful, well, not yet declared, but we all know, Jeb Bush said he's opposed to this opening, you know, of the thawing of relations with Cuba and the opening of Cuba. 50 years later, folks, because it's a, you know, enemy base basically in our hemisphere right off our coast. In other words, sort of citing some of the same concerns the Russians would have about NATO bases right on its border. And those people who say something like, Dan, you know, there's nothing in writing. We didn't promise we wouldn't do that. Does that make it smart, folks? Does that make it smart? You know, you go read Thucydides, who's one of the earliest authors we have who really gets into the nitty-gritty of power politics. Now, Thucydides is writing about power politics in ancient Greece. His book on the Peloponnesian War is a classic. Complicated as hell, but a classic. And one of the wonderful things it does is show you that even back in ancient Greece, the power politics was about as developed then as it is now. And there's a famous incident that happens in the book where the Athenians, one of the two great powers, along with the Spartans, this is 2,400 years ago, folks, goes to an ostensibly neutral city composed of a people called the Melians. And the Athenians tell the Melians that they need to surrender their city and start paying tribute to the Athenians. And the Melians make all these justice-based arguments about why they shouldn't do that. And the Athenians respond to the Melians that justice in international affairs is what happens between, you know, very powerful states. There is no justice, is what they're saying, for little minor powers like you. And it's the first time in recorded history you hear a version of the phrase that's very famous, that the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must. Now, Russia is far from weak, but that's not how we've been treating them. And this is where the mistake comes in, ladies and gentlemen. The mistake of treating Russia as though they are Melians and not a major power. In other words, denying them justice because they're not a major state anymore. And what the Russians are trying to prove, and we'll get into what they've done in the last couple of days, that shows, at least to me, pretty clearly that they're attempting to prove that they are a major state and that they can hurt us and make life very difficult for us and remind us of how dangerous they can be if they want to. And they feel a need to do this because we are ignoring, you know, their rights as they see it. And in their mind, their rights are exactly what we would claim for ourselves if the shoe were on the other foot. The people who say, oh, you know, they didn't have any agreement in writing about expanding NATO, are essentially also saying, if they don't like it, what are they going to do? In the last week, the Russians have shown what they're going to do. I want to read you something from 16 years ago. And I have a feeling in my head that I already read this to you 5.5 months ago in the show that we did. But it's one of those written statements by a person who in this case is one of the great anti-communist cold warriors of all time, Pat Buchanan. Now, I don't agree with Pat Buchanan about 90% of things. But the reason to quote this is because Pat Buchanan is not a genius. He's not a Russian sympathizer either. If he can see this, and if he's willing to say it, then there are lots of people who saw this. He wrote 16 years ago this. Russia is today a bankrupt, demoralized nation whose presidency is lusted after by Democrats, demagogues, ex-generals, and communists, with a single conviction in common. All believe NATO expansion to be a provocation, an example of American bad faith in exploiting Russian weakness. Russian military analyst Pavel Felgenhauer warns that, quote, public opinion is changing. NATO expansion will turn a whole generation of Russians anti-American, end quote. Buchanan continues, we soothingly reassure Moscow that NATO's expansion is benign, but if the Russians gave war guarantees to Mexico and began arming and training Mexican troops, would any Russian assurance diminish our determination to run them out of the hemisphere? If rising resentment in Russia leads to Yeltsin's replacement with an anti-American nationalist, full blame must rest squarely with a haughty U.S. elite that has done its best to humiliate Russia. Why are we doing this? End quote. As I said, Pat Buchanan is one of the most famous, most hawkish anti-communists this country has ever produced. He's also not a genius. If he can see it, lots of other people did too. Why did they ignore the obvious? Because of money. Because of opportunity. There's a reason that U.S. and Western companies are swarming into Ukraine to do business and gobble up, you know, mining rights and gas opportunities and all these kinds of things. It's what we all do, right? Once you open the world up to exploitation, everybody wants to get in and freely compete, we in the United States would say, you know, in a capitalistic marketplace for the ability to develop and enhance the natural resources and whatnot of Ukraine. It's all understandable. Unless, of course, it pisses off a major nuclear power. And the attitude that people have had when this has been brought up, Buchanan is hardly the only person to suggest that we be careful here, is what are they going to do about it? I specifically remember people saying, listen, the Russians are a country whose birth rate is dropping. They're a drunken mess. They've lost all of their former territories. They're nothing to worry about. But now they are. And many of us said the whole time that anybody with that many nuclear weapons is always someone to worry about. Vladimir Putin, and I said this in the last show, and people just got pissed off at me, is Russia's answer to Ronald Reagan. Let me remind those of you who were not around or not old enough to remember. When Jimmy Carter was president at the end of his first term, and he only had one, this country appeared to be falling apart. And a lot of it wasn't Jimmy Carter's fault. I mean, there were a lot of trends coming together that just screwed the United States in the late 70s. But Carter seemed powerless to do anything about it, nor did he talk big about it. It looked as though the United States was in a post-Vietnam decline, like we'd lost our edge, like we could be taken advantage of, and we couldn't even, you know, save our hostages from Iran. And when we tried, the helicopters crashed in the desert and we looked like idiots. And instead of, you know, rattling a saber, Carter basically said that the country's problems were that we had this bad attitude. He called it a malaise. Into that vacuum stepped Ronald Reagan, who, as most of you know, I did not like, but I didn't like Carter either. So, I mean, I'm pretty consistent. I don't like any of them. But the marketing slogan used by Reagan's campaign was that he would help America stand tall again. Now, that was totally geared towards, you know, addressing the pain that a once formerly proud country had at finding themselves all of a sudden impotent, seemingly. Vladimir Putin is Russia's, you know, person who's promising to help them stand tall, to once again, you know, regain their great power status and to push back against violations of Russian sovereignty. Folks, the idea that we could have NATO bases all around Russia, right on their borders, is asinine. And people will question your patriotism if you say that. That's another thing I find fascinating, that suggesting that the Russians should feel upset about that is somehow un-American, somehow, you know, non-patriotic. If you hired Dan Carlin to be the arbitrator between Russian and Western disputes, and the Russians said, you know, they've got U.S. and NATO military bases, you know, 50 miles from our border, and the U.S. says, well, you shouldn't worry about that, the arbitrator's going to say, would you? Now, here's the thing. What does that mean? Does that mean Russia should have the right to go in and dictate to these former territories, which are now free states, how they should live? That they should be able to dominate them? That they should have carte blanche to behave any way they want in Ukraine because it's in their sphere of influence? Well, here's the thing. Does the U.S. do that in its sphere of influence? We certainly have a ton of control over Mexico's policy, but we don't run Mexico. But we won't let Mexico be co-opted as a base for the Chinese military either. The mistake, as many people have said, again, none of this is Dan Carlin originality, by the way, folks. I'm just siding with a cabal of people who've mentioned this stuff for a long time. The mistake was not disbanding NATO after the Cold War. And there are a lot of reasons for that, and many of you conservatives out there will understand that it's a lot like other government programs. NATO's not really a government program per se, you know, like Social Security is a government program, but there's a momentum once you start these things. There's a lot of people who have jobs in this entity. There's a lot of money going to it. There's a lot of interest going to it. It's very difficult to stop something like that. And what the people in NATO did was repurpose it. That was exactly the phrase used, repurpose NATO. In other words, we had this wonderful entity that is so darn useful that just because there's no Soviet Union anymore, does that mean we need to get rid of this useful entity, fire all these people, and then recreate something else from scratch to do some of the same job? Yeah, that's what we should have done. Because NATO came with baggage. And the baggage was, it was anti-Russian in its very creation. I'll tell you what we should have done. We should have realigned the alliance systems. If it were up to me, in a perfect world, and, you know, whenever you talk about these things, there's always unintended consequences. So let's understand that things like that can exist. But I would have had all the former Soviet republics ally with each other. And anyone else in Central or Northern Europe that wanted to be a part of it, and let them form an organization with a similar sort of, you know, trigger to what NATO has. NATO has something called Article 5. Article 5 is the key to NATO. Article 5 says that an attack on any NATO member is an attack on the entire alliance. So right now, if the Russians were to attack Lithuania, that's an attack on Tennessee, and we have to treat it the same. But if Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Ukraine, Romania, Finland, all these places, Finland wasn't under the Soviet yoke and the Warsaw Pact and all that. But if all these countries that are right next to Russia and worried about it banded together so that they had their own version of Article 5 protection, and if Russia did what it's seemingly doing in Ukraine right now, it would trigger a war with 5 or 6 or 7 other countries overnight, I bet you they think twice about it. It reduces or eliminates the ability to pick countries off one by one. And while I can imagine that there would be a lot of people in Eastern Europe who would say, Dan, the Russians would not be dissuaded by a bunch of small countries like that, let me point out that I bet a country as powerful as the United States is now, and there has never been a country that is as powerful as the United States is relative to its neighbors as we are now, the United States would be dissuaded by a minor three-power alliance between middle to small nation states. For example, we have said pretty much openly that we will not allow Iran to get nuclear weapons. That may change with some of these negotiations, but that's the stated policy of the United States. What will the United States do if word comes down next week that Iran is a week and a half from a nuclear weapon being operational? Well, traditional statecraft, if you go by the last 50 years, would suggest that either the United States or one of our allies would launch a bombing raid to try to take out a facility that might contain such a weapon. Obviously, it might be at multiple facilities. This isn't a show about that. But my point is that something like that has a past. It would not be an uncommon occurrence. The Israelis took out one of Saddam Hussein's reactors in 1981 that way. While the United States might not consider that a war with Iran, I imagine Iran would consider that an act of war with the United States. And most Americans would probably say, who cares? Big deal. What's Iran going to do? It's not that dissimilar an attitude, by the way, from how we feel about Russia, right? Yeah, big deal. What are they going to do? Here's the thing. What if the Iranians had an alliance with a couple of other states? Maybe not very powerful states, but just a couple of other countries. North Korea and a country to be named later. Something about that same size, though, right? If the United States knew that a bombing raid on Iran would mean that we were at war with not one country, but three countries the next day, I don't know if that would stop us, but I know it would give us pause. It would give us more pause than we would care about if we were just at war with Iran, right? If a little teeny minor three-power alliance like that could make us think twice, what would an alliance between several, maybe five, six, seven Eastern, Southeastern, and Northern European countries do to the Russians? And remember, if that existed and somehow war broke out between Russia and that, you know, alliance of Central European states, that doesn't preclude whatever successor comes after NATO from intervening itself at some point and putting its foot on the scale. I mean, if we're 3 weeks into the war between Russia and the Ukrainian-Romanian Baltic alliance, you know, it would be very easy for Britain, France, the United States, or what have you to turn around and say, this war has to stop or we're intervening on the side of the Central European alliance. In other words, you don't take that opportunity off the table, but you certainly, you know, change the entire equation from the Russian standpoint, where you no longer have NATO positioning nuclear weapons basically within sight with binoculars of the Russian homeland. In other words, you diffuse tensions. And again, what drives me crazy about this whole thing is when you will talk to people, especially 10 years ago, you talk to people about diffusing tensions, and they would say to you, why? Who cares? They're not a threat. In other words, you know, almost bringing up Thucydides again and suggesting that the only reason you care about diffusing tensions or any kind of justice between powers is when you're talking about powers of somewhat relative strength. The Russians are through. Who cares? They might as well be Iran, but they're not. I have a bunch of stories in my hands from the last 36 hours. What they show, in my opinion, is an almost desperate attempt on the part of Russia to remind the rest of the world that they are relevant. They are not the Melians of Thucydides. They are more like the Spartans, and they will be taken seriously. This is a BBC News story from today, the 20th of February, 2015, entitled, Ukraine, UK and EU badly misread Russia from the beginning of the piece. Quote, the UK and the EU have been accused of a, quote, catastrophic misreading, end quote, of the mood in the Kremlin in the run-up to the crisis in Ukraine. The House of Lords EU committee claimed Europe, quote, end quote, sleepwalked into the crisis. The EU had not realized the depth of Russian hostility to its plans for closer relations with Ukraine, it said. The story then quotes UK Prime Minister David Cameron saying the blame for what has happened in Ukraine, quote, lies absolutely squarely with Vladimir Putin and Russia, end quote. Well, that's interesting. So if the House of Lords says that the EU had not realized the depth of hostility for plans for closer relations with Ukraine, and then Britain's prime minister says it's all Vladimir Putin's fault. Whose fault is it? Should the EU have done a better job of realizing the depth of hostility Russia might have felt? What Cameron is saying there is it doesn't matter that they feel hostility. They're not allowed to feel hostility. It's their fault if they feel hostility. Again, I would suggest that if the shoe were on the other foot, we would feel hostile. The British are feeling pretty hostile right now after finding Russian bombers not that far off their coast yesterday. That's Vladimir Putin reminding the British that they are not the Melians of ancient Greece. The story continues talking about the House of Lords' report, quote, the committee's report said Britain had not been, quote, active or visible enough, end quote, in dealing with the situation in Ukraine. It blamed Foreign Office cuts, which it said led to fewer Russian experts working there, and less emphasis on analysis. A similar decline in EU foreign ministries has left them ill-equipped to formulate a, quote, authoritative response, end quote, to the crisis, it said. The story continues, quote, "The report claimed that for too long the EU's relationship with Moscow had been based on the, quote, optimistic premise, end quote, that Russia was on a trajectory to becoming a democratic country. The result, it said, was a failure to appreciate the depth of Russian hostility when the EU opened talks aimed at establishing a, quote, association agreement, end quote, with Ukraine in 2013. Mr. Cameron rejected claims that Britain sleepwalked into the crisis, the story says. Now, how bad is this situation? Well, I've been telling the people on Twitter, no worries, this isn't going to spiral into any kind of a World War III. No chance of that. Well, this from the British paper The Telegraph, February 20th, 2015, from the beginning of the piece, quote, "Tensions with Russia could blow up into an all-out conflict, posing, quote, an existential threat to our whole being, end quote, Britain's top general in NATO has warned. General Sir Adrian Bradshaw, deputy commander of NATO forces in Europe, the story says, said there was a danger that Vladimir Putin could try to use his armies to invade and seize NATO territory, after calculating the alliance would be too afraid of escalating violence to respond. His comments, the story says, follow a clash between London and Moscow after the defense secretary, Michael Fallon, said that there was, quote, a real and present danger, end quote, Mr. Putin could try to destabilize the Baltic states with a campaign of subversion and irregular warfare, end quote. The Kremlin, the story says, called those comments absolutely unacceptable. The story continues. Sir Adrian told the Royal United Services Institute that there was a danger that such a campaign of undercover attacks could paralyze NATO decision-making, as members disagreed over how much Russia was responsible and how to respond. NATO commanders, the story says, fear a campaign of skillfully disguised, irregular military action by Russia, which is carefully designed not to trigger the alliance's mutual defense pact. He said the resulting ambiguity would make collective decisions relating to the appropriate responses more difficult, end quote. In other words, he's suggesting that the Russians might have found a little bit of a chink in the organizational armor of NATO. This question about Article 5, when was Russia actually attacking a NATO member state? Are they attacking Ukraine right now? Ukraine, of course, not a NATO state, but if the same playbook were followed in a Baltic country, for example, which are NATO members, would you at any time be able to say Russia attacked you? Or would it look like Russian minorities in Latvia were trying to secede? And even if the Latvians said the Russians are attacking us, would the other NATO members agree with that? In other words, it's a wonderful strategy to divide NATO. Does France really want to get into a war with Russia? Probably not. What does that mean? It means they might look at a situation in Latvia, similar to a situation in Ukraine, and go, no, we don't see that Article 5's been triggered. Now, does this make Putin a bad guy? Well, of course it does. Of course it does. You shouldn't be doing this. This is where Dan Carlin's own views come into play. And my views are pretty consistent. And if you go back and look at my reaction to that Ronald Reagan speech we talked about earlier in 1986, I was 100% against the United States intervening in the affairs of Nicaragua. If Nicaragua wanted to go communist, my attitude at the time was let them. I've always thought that the greatest argument against something like communism was letting people live under it for a little while. But I was in the minority then. Once again, Dan Carlin's the bad guy, doesn't want to fight communism, you know, a two-hour flight from the U.S. border. But my idea was, listen, countries should be allowed to pick their own governments. I feel the same way about Ukraine. But here's the thing. In the same way that the United States government wasn't going to let a communist, you know, stronghold be so close to our border, the Russians aren't going to let a NATO stronghold be so close to theirs. Doesn't matter what Dan Carlin's views on Ukraine are. They're too idealistic. This is Thucydides. This is age-old international relations. And just because we don't feel like the Russians should feel bad about what's going on in Ukraine doesn't mean they won't. That's wishful thinking, right? My own personal view is if we had stayed, and this is what I said in Poking the Bear, if we'd have stayed out of this, if the EU had stayed out of this, if we hadn't gotten involved in any of those various orange revolutions or trying to establish a democratic base for Western-oriented parties in Ukraine, then maybe we're not here right now. And if you're Ukrainian and you say, well, listen, those of us in the West want to be more a part of EU, why would you deny that to us? I would ask you if, knowing what you know now, right, knowing that by driving out the pro-Russian president, the one that some of the east of Ukraine liked better, that you would lose Crimea and that you would be involved in this crisis right now, if you could go back with hindsight, would you do it again? Ukraine would have been better off if the West had stayed out, had respected Russia's paranoia and xenophobia, and let's be honest, the same sort of attitudes about sphere of influence that the United States has in its hemisphere. But this would have meant denying ourselves the opportunities created by the fall of the Soviet Union to now treat Ukraine the way we treat a bunch of other countries we can go in and invest in and whatnot, make corporate deals in. And the thing is we're all going to pay the price for this, but it was always just a few people who were going to benefit from this. If some U.S. corporation goes into Ukraine and signs a resource extraction deal or a gas deal or whatnot, that doesn't benefit you and it doesn't benefit me. It benefits some specific group and some stockholders. But if there's a nuclear war that breaks out in a worst-case scenario, we're all paying the price for that. Doesn't just hit the gas company that made the provocative deal, right? One of the things I've always loved about things like the WikiLeaks revelations, and you know what WikiLeaks is. It's one of those groups that makes secret diplomatic cables public and whatnot. And what I've always said is wonderful about those things is it allows us to pull the curtain back and see what's really going on in the world sometimes. You know, there's all these platitudes and excuses and attitudes that form sort of the public opinion and the established accounts of what's going on. And then you see the WikiLeaks cables and you see the great game exposed. You see all these various powerhouses, whether they be Western corporations or Russian firms or whatnot, fighting for influence and access in a place like Ukraine. They drive the actions of the major powers, right? Who wants Ukraine open for the West? Is it American people, you know, pushing for a Ukraine that's more, you know, in line with our side of the Western map rather than the Eastern side? No, it's a bunch of companies, folks. It's a bunch of people who see investment opportunities and whatnot. Now, the Ukrainian people may not form that group. They may very well want to, you know, align themselves with the Czechs and the Slovaks and the people in Central Europe who are obviously a part of the European side of things, the Western European side of things. But again, like the Melians of Thucydides, they really don't have a say. They're along for the ride. This is the Spartans and the Athenians deciding what gets to happen here. And the attitude of the Athenians in this case is that the Spartans don't matter anymore. And if you say that long enough, the Spartans might decide to arm and come climbing over the passes heading toward Athens. If you treat a great power like they are not a great power, there will come a time where they may feel the need to remind you. I would suggest that Vladimir Putin doing this is going to be popular with his people the same way that Ronald Reagan, you know, reminding the American people that you are not in decline after Vietnam, you are still a great people, and you can stand tall. It's the same appeal to the national pride of a very proud people. And the fact that we seem unable to see that and incorporate that into our strategies is a huge blind spot. Like I said, if Pat Buchanan can see it 16 years ago, it's not exactly veiled. It's not exactly hidden. He's not a genius. He's one of many people who said it, though. And why didn't we listen? Well, there's that old line, and I'm going to misquote it here. But if a person's job depends upon them not seeing certain facts, they will not see it. If people want to invest and see opportunities to go in there and co-opt a bunch of these areas, and you have to have NATO protection to ensure, for example, the long-term security of that gas extraction deal that we're making with Ukraine, that's what you're going to push. The Clinton administration, for example, was woefully reckless in how they treated you know, Russian sensibilities. And again, the attitude was, who cares? It's a drunken disaster of a country run by a bunch of kleptocrats, and it doesn't matter. Guess what? It matters now. And it matters so much that we are in the most potentially dangerous situation we've been in since the Cold War ended. You know, look at worst case scenarios. That was a wonderful part of international relations courses. I've never forgotten it. The ability to look at worst case scenarios. And World War I was always one of those object lesson accounts where you know, you study, you know, what people thought would happen and then how things can go entirely wrong if the worst case scenario shows up. What's the worst case scenario of invading Iraq and getting Saddam Hussein out of there? Well, it may be the rise of ISIS down the road, and it might mean the loss of lots of lives in the region, but it's not nuclear war. What's the worst case scenario of intervening in the Balkan wars that cropped up when the former Yugoslavia disintegrated? Well, it's not nuclear war. Going after Manuel Noriega in Panama in the 1980s, it's still not nuclear war. Going into Afghanistan after 9/11, it's still not nuclear war. The worst case scenario in what we're dealing with now, if everything broke the wrong way, is tens of millions of deaths. And I talked to a guy the other day, and he sounded like one of these Clinton triumphalists when he said, listen, if we get into a war with Russia, we will kick their ass. And I said, I absolutely agree with that. How many people will we lose when we do? So one thing about nuclear weapons, ladies and gentlemen, it guarantees you, at best, a Pyrrhic victory. If we destroyed the Russian military and beat the hell out of them in a war, but lost 20 million people doing it, is that a victory? And if that ever happened, and again, I cannot imagine, maybe that's just the human mind recoiling from worst-case scenarios, I can't imagine that happening, but if it did, in the world that followed, in the rubble being cleaned up and the smoke clearing and the bodies being buried, you know, just after a very similar attitude, but maybe on steroids to what we had after both world wars ended, what do you think the survivors are going to think of the reckless statesmen on all sides who ignored obvious warnings and signs and got us to that point? What do you think we're going to think of those people? I hear a guy like John Kerry talk about the situation in Ukraine, and he sounds like he's brain damaged. Brain damaged. Now, I don't know if that's John Kerry's real attitude or if he goes into a meeting and they all sit there and talk about, okay, what's the spin we're going to put on this? Okay, here's the talking points. When you go out and talk to the press, John, here's what we want you to say. Maybe it's not brain damaged, you know, on a personal level. Maybe this is a brain damaged national policy. But folks, again, and I hate to quote Richard Nixon all the time, but sometimes what international affairs are missing is the thinking big part. We are reacting in the most obvious fashion. There's a line that people have brought up to me several times during this last year or two while this crisis has been brewing, and that's that Putin is playing chess while the West is playing checkers. The West has to think beyond the knee jerk at this point. What that British military NATO commander was saying in that article about how the Russians could potentially figure out a way around the NATO Article 5 trigger point, you know, by maybe just allowing Russian separatists in all these former Soviet Union territories to destabilize them, that's an example of how somebody might play chess. What do you do if that happens? My point in this whole show has been that none of this needed to happen if we were more concerned with Russian sensibilities. And for those people who say, Dan, you don't understand, Putin is Hitler, Russia was going to do this regardless as soon as they gain their strength back, then why would the United States do the same thing? The United States isn't run by Hitler. The United States is not a genetically expansionist country designed on taking over the whole world, but it does act in a pretty typical power politics way. Why did we expect the Russians wouldn't? And I do have a theory about this, and we mentioned it in the last program. The theory is that everybody who's running the show on the Western side of this has grown up and established their careers in a very unusual period in world history, the period after the fall of the Soviet Union. Remember, folks, the fall of the Soviet Union is like 25 years ago. That means that people who are 50 years old right now in positions of authority in the Pentagon and in NATO and whatnot and in diplomatic hierarchies in all these countries, that their entire adult careers that involve them having personal responsibility have come at a time where they haven't had to worry about great power face-offs. There was one great power. They're the kind of people who had to sit there and worry about worst-case scenarios with Saddam Hussein. This is not like that. This is a situation where, you know, American, especially diplomats and policymakers, have not had to deal with since they were junior officers going and getting coffee for the people who did have to make these decisions. And when you see us playing checkers to Putin's chess, it's because the people in those positions have never had to play chess against nuclear powers. They've only had to play checkers. And right now, you can see by the way they're acting, that's all they know how to play. They're learning on the fly. To me, I think you can see a perfect example of this playing checkers and not knowing exactly how to respond to the Russians when you see these attempts, for example, to squeeze the Russian economy with oil prices and the sanctions and all that. That sounds like a great way to deal with Iran or with Saddam Hussein or those kinds of opponents. The problem is, and as some of the older people out there, the older diplomats who've weighed into this, I mean, you know, there are people like Kissinger who will talk about this stuff. The problem with that is if you push a power as strong as Russia into corners like that, you almost force them to do things that are the exact thing you are trying to prevent. If you squeeze Saddam Hussein in Iraq until he squeals, he can't do very much about that. You push the Russians into a deep enough corner, and they may begin to think, especially their leadership may begin to think, that they've got nothing to lose. I mean, better to strike out and hope that some sort of offensive military activity shocks the West into a better deal than to sit there and slowly strangle due to Western sanctions. A wounded bear is a hell of a lot more dangerous than a happy one. Russia's concerns have been something we've been blowing off for so long that what they're doing now is not surprising. Just remember this, folks. A wounded animal is about the most dangerous, unpredictable thing you're going to ever run into. We're treating Russia, once again, like the Malians, like Saddam Hussein, like the people in Afghanistan, like Manuel Noriega, like the Bosnians and the Serbs and the Croats and all these minor powers that's what we have experienced in the past 25 years dealing with. They're not like that. There's a reason that we didn't mess with the Russians during the Cold War. When the Russians went in to Hungary in 1956 and the Hungarians pled for Western support, please come save us. You know, Radio Free Europe had been telling us to rise up and all these things. You know what the West did in 1956 to help the Hungarians? Nothing. In 1968, during the Prague Spring, when basically a very similar thing happened, you know, with the Czechoslovakians, same thing. What did the West do? Nothing. You know why? Because this wasn't Saddam Hussein. This was a major, powerful nation that required very deft handling and, you know, extreme care. We've forgotten how to act in any situation that doesn't involve U.S. hegemony. There's an arrogance to us, a hubris, and a lack of concern about what other people think. And what the Russians are trying to remind us of now is that sort of an attitude can lead to, you know, the kinds of responses that haven't been possible since the Soviet Union fell. And knowing, as I do, how shockingly dense sometimes our leaders can be, I'm scared. Now, when I suggest that the United States might not be that happy if Russia started doing the same thing to the United States that the United States is doing, you know, to Russia, putting military forces in what it considers its sphere of influence, Russia is going to test that question and sort of say that two can play at that game and turnabout is fair play. I have a story from the Associated Press from today, February 20th, 2015, by Bill Gertz, entitled "Russia Boosts Arms Training for Leftist Latin Militaries." From the beginning of the piece, quote, Russia agreed to provide military training for three leftist regimes in Latin America and increase military visits and exercises following a visit last week to the region by Moscow's defense minister, end quote. Now, our government realizes that this is Russia's attempt to get the U.S. to say, hey, you can't do that, and then point out, well, you're doing it near us. So the Obama administration's acting like, hey, no big deal, from the middle of the piece. Quote, defense officials, meaning U.S. defense officials, said the Russian leader is seeking bases in the region for strategic bomber flights that the Russian defense minister recently promised would include flights over the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. U.S. intelligence agencies closely monitored the visit, but a Pentagon spokeswoman played down the Russian military encroachment. Quote, just as we have bilateral and multilateral relationships around the world, so do other nations, Pentagon spokeswoman Eileen M. Linetz told the Washington Free Beacon. All nations are free to choose their associations as they see fit. End quote. Really? Well, maybe they should talk to the Republicans about that. Quote, Representative Mike Pompeo, Republican from Kansas, a member of the House Permanent Select Intelligence Committee, said, quote, the Russian bear is out of hibernation, from Damascus to Donetsk and from Pyongyang to Peru. Putin and his coterie of former communists smell weakness, Pompeo said. Their window to expand Russian influence is now, and they're acting with great vigor and with nearly zero resistance from America and the West. Russian military expansion into Latin America is simply one more manifestation of their resolve and American inaction, end quote. The Russians, the story says, have increased the number of bomber flights near the U.S. coasts in recent months. Again, the British just dealt with this the other day. This is an attempt to sort of show that if we don't like your militaries near our border, how do you feel when our militaries get near you? The Russians told Venezuela that they will be happy to take part in some of their military exercises in the near future. In November, the Russian defense minister, the story says, announced that Russian strategic nuclear bombers would conduct long-range training flights in the Gulf of Mexico. Quote, in the current situation, we have to maintain a military presence in the Western Atlantic and Eastern Pacific, as well as the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, end quote. Folks, this is a high-stakes game of chicken. It's a see-how-you-like-it kind of maneuver. And even though the Obama administration realizes this is an attempt to expose American hypocrisy, they're trying not to play the game, but they can't shut the Republicans up, who are saying exactly what you're going to hear more of as the United States begins to see more and more Russian activity in the Americas. We'll see how dead the Monroe Doctrine is now. The piece ends thusly and starts with a quote from the Russian news outlet Pravda. Quote, this long-term strategy imposes obligations on Russia to supply its allies in Latin America with advanced weapons, including air defense systems, aircraft, and warships, Pravda stated. The story says, quote, former United Nations Ambassador John Bolton said the Russians appear to be filling a power vacuum in the region by the lack of focus from the Obama administration, quote, Russia's perception of American weakness under Obama has fueled their new adventurism in this hemisphere, Bolton said. Since I see no chance of Obama waking up to the potential threat, I'm very worried about the situation a new president will face in January 2017, end quote. The story says Dan Gouri, a Russian expert with the Lexington Institute, said Russia's current moves into Latin America are, quote, like a page Xeroxed from the Soviet political military playbook, end quote. He says, quote, now, like then, the Kremlin is attempting to counter what it perceives as Western encirclement by operating in America's backyard, Gouri said. Gouri continues, quote, the U.S. deploys missile defenses in Eastern Europe and sends warships into the Black Sea, so the Russian military is attempting a counter by orchestrating naval visits to Venezuela and seeking to reopen its intelligence facility in Cuba, end quote. The story ends by saying, quote, Gouri said Moscow is seeking to encourage anti-American sentiment in the region, quote, much the same way as it perceives the U.S. has done to Russia in the so-called color revolutions, end quote. So I guess the Russian attitude on this is, if you're going to put your military forces in what we consider to be our defense zone, we're going to make sure to up our presence in yours. Let's see how that plays long term. Are we hypocrites, or are we going to be just fine with it? History would suggest we won't be. It'll be very interesting to see how the United States reacts if we get a close flyby on our coastline from a Russian nuclear military bomber, as the British had near Cornwall yesterday. And let's remember, by the way, that the way the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s was settled was with a deal. The United States took Jupiter missiles out of Turkey, which were in range of striking Russian targets, and the Russians removed missiles from Cuba. This is the Russian attempt to create the material for some sort of trade. You get away from our zone of control, and we'll get out of yours. If nothing else, it's designed to expose the two-sided hypocrisy and to make the United States feel just a little like it must feel to the Russians to have adversarial military forces so near to its territory. Stay tuned for more on that. It's a fantastically clever strategy, though, isn't it? It reminds one again of a chess game. And I have to tell you, those of you who tweeted to me, could we be seeing the beginnings of the dominoes that would tumble and lead to a third world war? And I told you no. You may be more right than I am, because all of a sudden, I can start to see, admittedly, very hard to believe, a lot of things would have to go wrong to go that route, but all of a sudden, I can see the potential, if everything broke the wrong way, for Armageddon in the distance. And that right there is enough of a wake-up call for us to start thinking big about how we get out of this mess and how we redesign things to reflect what we're learning here. And the first thing that we're learning is that this lone superpower world where the U.S. can act any way it wants to act and everybody besides us is essentially a Malian is untrue. You know, we did a show recently called Dissing and Dueling, where we talked about, you know, what happens sometimes when people feel disrespected. Well, maybe the same applies to countries. And for 25 years, we've been treating Russia like a drunken, homeless person on the street who used to be great and now elicits our pity and scorn. And what Vladimir Putin seems to be trying to do is to tell us that those days are over. I think with the amount of nuclear weapons they have, we would be wise to take note. And if you happen to live in one of those countries that either was under the Soviet boot, or even before then, the Russian Empire's boot, and you're concerned, and I think you have a right to be, I think we have to start trying to find ways to improve your security outlook that doesn't at the same time undercut the security outlook for the Russians. I think it can be done, but I don't think it can be done with NATO. I think NATO's got to go. And the sheer fact that I can't imagine our leaders being willing to embrace a post-NATO world bodes ill for all of us. One of the really great things about being a new media operation that relies on listener donations for its existence is that we can afford to be incredibly choosy about any products or services we tell you about here on the show. You may have noticed it's a very small group of firms we're willing to tell you about. The ones we do mention are ones we believe in and ones we hear good things from you about. Case in point, Ting. Ting is mobile service made easy. It's a cell phone service company. They utilize the nationwide Sprint network to bring you, you know, cell phone service with an emphasis on customer service. That's not that common in the cell phone industry, you may have noticed. It couldn't be easier to get involved with what they do. Basically, you buy a phone through Ting and you'll get it in 2 to 5 business days. You activate the service. You can port your old number over if you like, or you can utilize a new phone number. And then you begin to utilize the service as you would with any other cell phone. The real difference comes at the end of the month when you get your bill and find out that you have only been charged for what you used. Again, That should be standard operating procedure. It often isn't. If you look at the list of benefits that Ting provides, you'll be shocked at how much negativity there is, how many times you will see the word no. And yet, every time you see the word no and Ting mentions it to you, you're going to get a bigger smile on your face. It's all the kind of no's that the customer appreciates. How about no contracts, for starters? That's one of my favorites. I can't stand a company that locks you into a contract and makes you pay to get out. I think that takes away all the incentive for good customer service. How about no early termination fees? In fact, if you're locked into a contract with an early termination fee with some other company, Ting will help you get out of it. That's pretty nice. How about no bundling or ride-along services? No overage charges or penalties? No add-on charges, no mysterious line items on your bill. That's a lot of no's, isn't it? But those are the kind of no's a customer likes to hear. How about this no? No hold customer support. If there is a ban, he's used that, and he raves about it. He also raves about the powerful online account control panel that allows him to customize his service easily. If you'd like to try Ting, wouldn't be a bad time now. All you have to do is go to dancarlin.ting.com, and you'll get $25 off your first device. And listen, we want to hear your feedback. Let us know how you liked it.
If you are not already following us on Twitter, please do so. The address is @DC Common Sense.
Are you feeling guilty yet? A buck a show. It's all we ask. Thanks again for all your buck a show donations. They're the reason we're still here.